Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. Good morning. It is 9:04 a.m. on KYMN Radio, and today is the third Monday of February, which means we are joined by Justice Gordon Moore for Legal Talk. Good morning, Mr. Justice. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Rich. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Happy President's Day to you, sir.
Or Washington's birthday, as I think it's technically still called. But it's another snowpalooza event apparently coming to our greater environs. But
Snowmageddon, part three on its way. Yes. Part three, part four, I don't even know anymore.
It'll give the meteorologist something to talk to us about for a few days. Hey, I was hearing your birthdays coming in today. Walter Becker, wanted to make a comment about Walter Becker.
Of Steely Dan.
You know, for those of us like you and I that grew up and listening to music in the 70s and early 80s. Yes, Steely Dan, Walter Becker. What an amazing songwriter and guitarist.
And what I think Walter Becker doesn't get enough credit for, I mean, Donald Fagen is the voice of Steely Dan. Walter Becker, though, did a lot of the production work on those albums and is as much responsible for crafting that sound, that really polished 70s sound, as anybody out there. Well, he was a great musician. I think he was actually a better producer.
You know, I agree with you, Rich. We got introduced by friends last night to an online game called Hurdle. Not to be confused with Wordle, but it's basically, can you name that tune in a certain number of notes?
Yes.
Have you done it? It's fun.
I have, and it's actually frustrating because a lot of the music is after my time.
Yes. Exactly. The 2000s, 2010s, Indianapolis.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, there are some Steely Dan songs, one chord, one note. Those of us who were around at that point,
You know that you hear three notes for reeling in the years, and you know
exactly
you're listening to.
Yeah,
exactly. All right. So it's been kind of, at least from the outside looking in, it looks like it's been a little bit of a busy month at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, we still have a couple of holdover cases from last term, and we issued a big one last week, the Schroeder case on the question of when the right to vote is reinstated for people that were convicted of a felony. I don't really want to comment on the opinion. I don't think that would be appropriate. It speaks for itself, but I would encourage people to read it. It's long, three opinions, 75 pages, and frankly, one of the strongest dissents that I've seen since I've joined the court by my colleague, Justice Natalie Hudson. Some real strong feelings on all sides of this issue. And if you look at the comments section to the article in the Star Tribune, you can see the length of the comments. And so it's obviously an issue that the legislature is addressing right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's important for people to understand that the state constitution is the source of the disenfranchisement. The Minnesota Constitution was enacted with this prohibition of people voting who are convicted of a felony. The legislature reinstated, legislature created a process to reinstate the right to vote. And so that's the statute that's at issue here, and whether it has a disproportionately unfair effect on persons of color.
Right.
The issue is challenging and complex. I just would encourage people to talk to their legislators to get involved. I want to stress for the benefit of the listeners that every member of the court recognized the fundamental nature of the right to vote, and it's we have to fiercely defend that.
Right.
And so there's just a question of, you know, when have people paid their debts? When have people done what they need to do to get their rights reinstated? And so the bills that are pending right now would reinstate the right to vote after people get out of incarceration.
Right. So just to reiterate my understanding is that the Supreme Court, you being a member of the Supreme Court, decided that it is not unconstitutional to bar a felon from voting, at least as far as the Minnesota state constitution goes, that it is not unconstitutional to do that.
Well, broadly, yes. I think specifically the issue is the process that Minnesota uses to reinstate the right to vote
okay.
is not unconstitutional. It doesn't okay. violate equal protection.
Okay.
And so, you know, yes, the voters elected to disenfranchise people who were convicted of felonies. And if you look at different states, there's different theories on this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this literally existed at statehood,
mm-hmm.
and if you read the opinion, it walks the reader through the history of who gets to vote in the state and why, and it's really an interesting history lesson in terms of how we have dealt with the right to vote. You know, there's some parts of that history that aren't frankly, the greatest to read about, frankly, as right. far as how we've treated, you know, certain members of our society.
Yes.
But let's just say that the issue's teed up at the legislature. It's definitely a political issue, and so the legislature is considering, you know, what to do with it right now. And I believe it's in the Senate, so right, we'll see right. what ends up happening.
And that is part of the decision that, as it's written, is that the legislature absolutely has the right to rule or to change that law.
Yeah, yeah, the Constitution disenfranchises, but the legislature has the right to establish the process for which right. the right is reinstated.
Right.
And
right.
so, you know, that's just an important issue, and yeah. I would encourage people to keep an eye on that. We've got, I think, one more holdover case from last year that's in the process of getting out, and I believe that's the last one, finally. We had another one involving the Department of Corrections that got issued. So our March calendar coming up here is, yeah. is a little bit of a quieter one. You know, the number of petitions for further review have been down,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's affecting our calendar. But two cases listeners might be interested in. On February 28th, there's a defamation case going before the state Supreme Court.
Okay.
This is Johnson versus Freeborg. And Johnson... asserted a defamation claim against Freeborg after she made Facebook posts that accused him of sexual assault. I think he was a former dance instructor, if I recall
okay.
correctly.
Okay.
The district court granted Freeborg's motion for summary judgment, ruling in part that the posts reached a matter of public concern, nearly the Me Too movement and sexual abuse, and Johnson could not understand actual malice. So if it's a matter of public concern, I mean, the rules regarding defamation are a little different.
Mm-hmm.
A divided panel of the Court of Appeals reversed the district court's ruling on the public concern issue and remanded it for a jury trial. And so the question is whether a statement concerning somebody like this involved a matter of public concern. It's a private issue between two people.
Mm-hmm.
But it implicates broader notions of kind of the Me Too movement
sure,
and people going
sure.
on social media and
yeah.
talking about,
yeah.
frankly, their own experiences.
Right, right.
And so I'd encourage people to keep an eye on that.
I have so many questions I want to ask you about that case, and I don't think I can ask you a single one.
Yeah, I can only tee it up.
Right.
You know, I think you right. just have to listen to it and think about it a little
yeah.
bit. And then on March 1st, the... air admissions permit for the Polymet mine in northern Minnesota is back before the Supreme Court.
It is.
Yes, for the second time. This time, the Court of Appeals basically dismissed the appeal for lack of appellate jurisdiction on the grounds that the appellants did not comply with the service requirements of the law to have this permit reviewed. And so it's a procedure case.
Okay.
But it has broad implications for appeals of agency action, and so
okay.
I'd encourage people to keep an eye on that one as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And then I think we might want to just touch briefly on the question of, you know, electing justices and
right.
the question of
right.
how different states
which
do
is
that.
Something we've talked about a couple of times on this show. Yeah, because Wisconsin is going through a primary right now.
They do. Yeah, there's a justice retired, and so there's an open seat, and so there's an election coming up, and it's very, very hot. If you look at the news out of Wisconsin, there's a lot of intense political debate on it, and it's even though the seat is allegedly nonpartisan, or it is nonpartisan,
well,
I mean, it's but there's...
Theoretically, it's
yeah,
supposed to be. Yeah.
Two people that are, you know, very conservative on one side, and two people that are more on the progressive liberal side.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of money, lots of outside money, campaigning, and kind of a spectacle, frankly.
Right,
and it's just,
right.
I bring it up only because it's such a thankfully a contrast for the most part, from what we have had in this state. I mean, our Supreme Court and Court of Appeals elections have been, for the most part, free of that type of influence.
Yes.
But you can see how easy it could be for a court to be caught up in you know, political issues.
Right.
And
right.
it's, you know, there's a, when a court is perceived as being, you know, like a 4-3 court or something, which I think the Wisconsin Supreme Court is viewed as, with people sort of predictably lining up on one side or the other of issues.
Right.
That's where, you know, we get into these hotly contested sort of political based races, which I think are really concerning for the, you know, the justice system.
I agree. One of the things that I'm very proud of as a Minnesotan, I don't really expect you to comment on this at all, but there does seem to be a lot of balance. I mean, there not even seems to be, there is a lot of balance on the on the bench at the Supreme Court of the state. And frankly, there has been for many, many years. And, you know, Chief Justice Lori Gilday, I think people would sort of, maybe she might identify personally even as a conservative, but you don't know that. You don't see that, because what we see coming out of the Supreme Court is pretty balanced stuff. I mean, you just talked about the decision that was issued, which you cannot talk about, but I mean, you did say there was a very strong dissent.
There was. There was a concurrence that was written by Justice Anderson that agreed with the result reached by the majority, which I was part of, that Justice Paul Thiessen wrote. But yes, I think we take pride in the fact that it's not always predictable what side people are going to be on. And that's because the law drives the decisions, the law and the analysis of it, not the results.
Yes. I mean,
you know, if you get into that kind of result-oriented jurisprudence where, you know, you want to go after a particular piece of legislation, or you want to rule in this particular way, and you try to figure out a way to get there, you know, that's a problem. That's not, the law isn't governing the results there. It's some policy agenda.
And that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. And so, we don't talk about politics. We don't talk about political ramifications of things. I mean, you know, we are trying our level best to issue decisions that are fair and are based on the law that's given to us. And I know that, you know, we're not deaf to comments. I mean, you can hear, you know, people on both sides of various issues. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we probably cause both sides to have some heartburn, but we're trying to, you know, where possible, reach a consensus-based decision that's understandable to the voters. And, you know, I mean, three opinions, that's a little unusual for our court. We usually don't have three opinions, and that's just a really unique case that involves some really tough issues.
Yeah, this was an unusual case. It took you a long time to reach that decision.
It took us a longer time than I think anybody had predicted or wanted. And, you know, sometimes cases, people ask sometimes, why do certain unanimous decisions take time to get out? Well, what people don't understand is what it took to get to a unanimous decision.
Exactly.
I mean, there's a lot sometimes that goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
So what I will say is, we are trying our level best to stay out of the political fray and, you know, issue decisions based on the Constitution and the law, and, you know, not political agendas. And so, you know, and so that, yeah, that probably, you know, it's in a, unfortunately, partisan divided world that we're in right now, that's likely to probably make, you know, nobody thrilled, but at least people understand that we're trying to be fair and balanced and you know, reach where we can a consensus decision. If we can get to unanimity, that's generally good for the court. That's, you know, not for the purpose of ducking issues, but for the purpose of trying to find common ground.
Yes.
Because that's what I think we need to try to do more often.
Right. Well, and I mean, it's what I think, you know, as a citizen of the state of Minnesota, what I want is thoughtful conversation And if it takes you a while to reach a decision, that's fine as long as you folks are giving it the, you know, the decision, the respect it deserves, which I believe you are doing.
Well, we certainly try.
Right.
So, yeah, we've got oral arguments will start up next week in the Supreme Court for March, and we'll kind of see how things go. We had our one argument get moved off the calendar, so it is a little bit of a lighter month, which hopefully will help us, frankly, catch up with some of the opinions. We're really striving to avoid cases being held over like we had last term, which, frankly, are frustrating to everybody. Yeah. So, you know, our clerks and the justices are working hard on that. And, yeah, hopefully, Rich, after the snow melts here, you'll keep issuing decisions and have them coming out in good order. And, you know, that's the way it goes. But, you know, we wanted to talk just a little more about the juvenile justice system.
Yes, sir.
We had sort of teed that issue up.
Yes, we had.
And that's an issue that's before the legislature, too, right now. Yeah. There are some bills right now that are pending. The Star Tribune has talked about them. There is a bill that is pending right now to put a lot more money into restorative justice for juveniles,
mm-hmm.
and to create a more uniform and equitable system for juvenile services. Because
mm-hmm.
what's happening right now, Rich, the juvenile justice system exists for a variety of purposes. Obviously, protecting public safety and promoting public safety is critical. But trying to rehabilitate juveniles is part of the goal here.
Yes.
And to develop individual responsibility for unlawful behavior, protect the child from their own worst behavior. I mean, there's a lot of goals here in the juvenile justice system. Obviously, holding juveniles accountable is important, but we're trying to not create career criminals out of kids.
Right.
I mean, people who are, you know, 14, 15-year-olds that, you know, make a boneheaded decision,
right?
You know, should that be with you the entire rest of your life? I guess part of it depends on how bad it was.
Yeah, exactly.
But so what we're talking about here with this legislation that's before the legislature right now relates to juveniles who are committing serious offenses.
Yes,
talk about felony offenses here, and these are juveniles certified to adult court, and that's where you have a juvenile that's over the age of 14 that's accused of a particularly dangerous offense or has engaged in criminal conduct in the past that would, you know, be more appropriately handled in adult court. So under the age of 14, there's no adult certification. But mm-hmm. 14 or older, you can be certified to adult court by motion by the prosecutor if there's probable cause to believe that you've committed a felony-level offense and there's clear and convincing evidence the public safety isn't served by handling the case in the juvenile court. And so once a juvenile goes to adult court, they can be treated like an adult defendant.
Okay.
Now, the law presumes that certain juvenile offenders will be certified to adult court for criminal prosecution, and those are 16 and 17-year-olds at the time of the offense that committed a felony offense that would result in a presumptive commitment to prison if they were adults under the sentencing guidelines, or any felony offense involving a firearm. So in that case, the law presumes adult certification. The child has the burden to rebut that presumption by clear and convincing evidence that retaining the case in juvenile court serves public safety. And so we've had a couple of these cases where there's a really close question as to whether it should be adult court or juvenile court.
Okay.
Now, if the case falls into juvenile court, it could be part of what is called an extended jurisdiction juvenile case, or EJJ. And what that does is it extends the time the court has jurisdiction over a juvenile till age 21. And so the conviction for an offense under the extended jurisdiction juvenile law stays an adult sentence but keeps the kid in juvenile court. And so if the kid, frankly, violates probation, mm-hmm. their adult sentence can then be executed.
Okay.
And this is the so-called pathway to prison that has been identified by certain people, that kids are in the probation system and they get revoked from probation for some, you know, so-called technical offenses,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly they find themselves in prison.
Right.
Now, from my experience in district court, juveniles don't have their EJJ sentences revoked for technical reasons, usually. Okay. I mean, most often, sadly, is because of another offense. But the question is, why are certain kids succeeding on probation and being given that chance to avoid adult sentences in adult court and other kids aren't? And the answer lies, I think, with the resources that are devoted to services for those juveniles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this legislation is talking about. Right now, Minnesota's probation system is a patchwork. Every county makes their own decisions regarding to how they handle cases.
Mm-hmm.
They can be part of the... We have three probation delivery models in the state. We have Department of Corrections, counties, county probation officer counties, and Community Corrections Act counties, where two or three or sometimes more counties come together to form a corrections organization. And frankly, Rich, the level of services varies a lot.
Yeah.
It just does. And that's, you know, part of the reality of the state here. Certain right. counties have a lot more resources than others.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, there are juveniles that need a lot of attention.
Yes.
And the concern is right now that the services and the consequences in juvenile court right now are not meeting the goal of public safety. If we're trying to, you know, change lives, divert kids away from a life of crime,
mm-hmm.
from escalating their behavior,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, all too often you're seeing stories in the paper of repeat offense juveniles where right. that's not happening.
Right.
And so the legislation to repair the state's juvenile justice system, Star Tribune did a five-part series investigating how the justice system, the quality of rehabilitation programs varies from county to county and how little oversight there is. And so what the proposal would do is create a state office of juvenile restorative justice that would promote, coordinate, and measure community-based approaches to youth crime, which in theory sounds good, but the reality is you've got to have people that are working with these juveniles on the street. There's probably going to have to be a significant investment
yeah.
in placement facilities
right.
for juveniles that need chemical dependency assistance, the mental health counseling.
Right. Right.
Sometimes there's PTSD involved
right.
because of circumstances in their home. There's a lot of factors that go into, you know, why people are involved in juvenile crime.
Sure.
And just putting people on probation and asking them to check in with a probation officer every month and, you know, assuming that they're going to do the things that they were ordered to do by the court, you know, that might be a little naive, frankly.
It's just not going to work always. Just,
it doesn't, unfortunately. Yeah. And, you know, so, you know, the goal here is to not send kids to prison for technical violations,
right.
but to reserve prison for those that, unfortunately, really need it.
Yeah.
They need to be removed from society for yeah. a period of time.
Yeah.
But for the tough, there's some tough circumstances that can be remedied with some good therapy and intervention from respected community elders, from people that are willing and able to give the time to these
mm-hmm.
kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the state has just got to pay more attention to the right. juvenile justice system right now, because, you know, these carjackings that people have heard about, some of the other, you know, violent
yeah.
crime.
Yep.
I mean, sadly, you know, we've stabbings in schools, we've got stabbings and shootings
yep.
and, you know, this is just unacceptable. And I think, you know, people's patience is really being taxed right now with the state of affairs.
I will be the first person to stand up and say that's a situation that you're talking about where we probably cannot allocate enough money to putting the resources into some of the ideas you're talking, people on the street to work with some of these kids and investing more and just check in with your probation officer once a month. But then I hear about, you know, the shooting of the young man at the Mall of America and the two people that they have in custody. It's my understanding, and I don't know the details, and I don't want to get out ahead of myself here, but it's my understanding that one of the kids that they have in custody, they think is connected to four, maybe five other shootings. And if that's the case, well, that's a public safety issue in my mind.
Yes.
The stabbing at Harding High School. was not, it, that was a situation between two individuals that was not unknown to St. Paul authorities, to the Harding High School authorities. Again, I don't want to get out ahead of myself, but there were, are reasons to believe people could have seen that coming. And because of the individuals that we're talking about, I don't think you can invest enough in our kids. And I don't think you can invest enough in getting the help to underprivileged kids, and to kids that are in really tough circumstances. But at the same time, you talk about a public safety issue. And sometimes that's exactly what this is. It's a public safety problem.
Yeah. No question about it, yeah. Rich. No question about it. And it's a multifaceted issue. It's county attorneys have to be working with law enforcement, with school districts, with corrections agencies to develop programming that has an effect, that mm-hmm. actually means something. If you're going to divert cases away from the adult prison system, there's got to be an appropriate response from the juvenile justice system,
yeah,
in terms of whatever the services that those juveniles need. And, you know, unfortunately, you can invest a lot of services in certain kids
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen that happen in district court. It's very disheartening, frankly.
Yeah.
But also what's very heartening is seeing kids where you maybe thought, you know, boy, this kid looks like they're a lost cause. And, you know, you get them with the right mentor, the right programming, the right group, and they turn it around.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think about yourself at age, you know, 17 years old. I don't think there's any of us who would want to be judged for the rest of our life by how we behaved at age 17.
No, thank you.
And, you know, for those of us who had the good fortune of living in a stable home,
yep,
with parents that were there, that took care of us and provided for us,
yep,
and supervised us and gave us the discipline we needed, right, when we needed,
right,
it. I mean, you know,
right,
you know, unfortunately right now the school districts oftentimes are, you know, left to sort of raise some of these kids, you know, and it's really putting a lot of pressure on schools. You know, the tension on, you know, do you have SROs in the schools?
Yeah.
I mean, that whole discussion.
That's a whole different thing.
That's,
yeah,
that's really it. There's got to be a working relationship between local law enforcement and the schools, because,
right,
that's, right, where, you know, SROs that are effective get a lot of information. They develop relationships. It's not about intimidating kids. It's about working with kids, mentoring kids, and frankly, just keeping an eye on kids.
Right.
Because that's what, you know, they need. I mean, you know, none of us, when we're 15 or 16, I mean, otherwise it's Lord of the Flies. You're kind of just doing whatever you want to do.
And yeah,
so we, you know, kids of that age need a watchful eye. And yeah, you're not going to eliminate every problem in the world. I don't mean to say here that there's, you know, by just throwing money at programming, that's going to solve every,
right,
juvenile justice issue.
Right.
But I think, you know, the Star Tribune and others have identified some real concerns about how effective our juvenile justice system is right now in dealing with serious criminal offenses being committed by underage, by, you know, 14 to 17 year old kids.
When I was 17 years old, right, my biggest concerns were, when was the next reissued Beatles album going to come out on CD? How was I going to afford to take Jennifer Lowinger to prom? And where was I going to go to college? Those were my issues. That's light years away from what a kid in, you know, North Minneapolis or Central St. Paul is dealing with. And we need to recognize that.
We've got to give a path to kids away from this foster care / juvenile justice system to prison, you know, concern.
Right.
Some call it a pipeline.
I, yeah,
mean, that's the concern, that once, yeah, kids are caught in those foster care and juvenile justice systems, that it's inevitable they're going to find their way in the adult prison system. And then, frankly, it's not a good thing. I mean, people become institutionalized. I mean, I used,
yeah,
to have defense attorneys telling me all the time, you know, Judge, you send this kid to prison, you're just going to basically ensure that they get taught how to be a, you know, a more effective criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of a a cold, hard thing to hear. But, you know, it is a concern that you run the risk of institutionalizing young people
yeah.
when they are subjected to an adult prison environment in teenagers. I mean, you know, how do we expect those kids to really change?
It is chilling, the idea of a 15-year-old going to a state penitentiary. I mean, that you know, I've seen the Scared Straight was the yes. You know, they take juvenile kids and they show them exactly what.
I participated in a few of those.
Did events. You really?
Yes, I did. Yeah, remember the old, we used to have a private prison out in western Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
out in, what's the community? Appleton, the Appleton okay. prison. And the judge in my jurisdiction in southwest Minnesota would order kids to go on what we called the prison tour.
Okay.
And so I went along on a couple of those as sort of a chaperone slash just out of curiosity.
Yep.
And the prison officials would pick certain inmates mm-hmm. that they felt could do this, had mm-hmm. the communication skills, and it was raw, it was blunt, and it was kind of brutal, frankly. They would sit these kids down in a circle and talk to them a little bit about what life is like in prison, and it was interesting how uncanny it was, how fast the inmates would identify the kids that were the real problems.
Oh, is that right?
The cocky, you know, you can't right? touch me. Oh, yeah. And I, you know, this Scared Straight program, you know, was not without its critics in mm-hmm. terms of how effective it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you what, I sat in rooms and watched kids that were some of the toughest, some of the biggest challenges get reduced to a basically a puddle.
By
inmates talking to them about what life is like behind bars.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. Years and years and years ago, as an adult, I took a tour of Alcatraz, right? And I remember saying to my buddy, this should go without saying, but I don't ever want to do anything that's going to land me in a place like this. And I was just a tourist, right? If you're looking at this in your future, I would think that this would be, I don't know, it strikes me as a pretty effective tool.
It, you know, for the right juvenile, it could be.
Yeah.
You know, for others, they frankly, I think, kind of saw it as just sort of a field trip. You know, it's, I don't know how frequently those tactics are used, but I think what really works is mentorship.
Yes.
Whether it's getting kids involved in sports, some, you know, community organizations, you've got to be thinking about more than just yourself, you know, mm-hmm. your community, your neighborhood, your buddies. I mean, and yeah, the violence is just unacceptable. I mean, yes, the violence is unacceptable.
Period.
And there's multi reasons for this, and it's well beyond the discussion about the juvenile justice system we're having here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your average person in this state is understandably very concerned about what we're seeing. And it's not just in large cities. It's, you know, it's in other communities as well. And the juvenile justice system needs to respond. There needs to be, I agree, more state-level monitoring of the services that are given, because it does vary so much. We have 87 counties, 87 different approaches to things. And I'm not saying that what works in Hennepin County should be imported to Kitson County or mm-hmm. Rock County, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got to design these programs with your audience involved.
Absolutely.
But we need to do more. We yeah. absolutely, for the welfare of the people and the benefit of our state, we need to do more. And so I would just urge people to stay in tune on this issue, talk to legislators, listen to the discussions that are happening with leaders. It's entwined with, you know, educational outcomes. There's some really challenging questions about whether educational disparities exist, and to the extent that they do, how they contribute to some of this climate, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have work to do as a state. It's a great state with a proud tradition of education and to, you know, it's a good place to live. But there have been some cracks showing over the past few years. There's no question about that.
Indeed. Indeed. Justice Gordon Moore of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Anything else you'd like to talk about today, sir?
You know, on a lighter note, Rich, I guess the Minnesota Wild find ways to score goals with shots off of Ryan Hartman.
Ryan Hartman can giveth and he can taketh away. One bounces in and off of his chest and we lose a game. Another one bounces in off his chest and we win.
Yeah, I don't know if he really needs a stick anymore, but yeah, I'll be watching with interest to see what happens here with the Wild over the next couple of weeks. Are they sellers? Are they buyers right now? They're in a wild card position, but... You know, yeah, it's kind of hard to see them giving up a bunch of, you know, future assets for rentals at this point. I'm guessing they probably are more or less going to stay put.
I know that they would really like to move Matt Dumba, but I don't know if they can, in the where they're sitting right now, I don't know if they can afford to do that or not.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting end of the season. Then, of course, our Timberwolves are, you know, confounding us. One day it looks wonderful, next day it doesn't.
Oh, they're winning. Any more words of Kevin Garnett? We're coming.
The Twins are reconvening and for you, Rich, down in Fort Myers, so
puts the big smile on my face.
Spring is coming.
I don't even care if they top 500. I at this time of year, I'm just happy to know that spring is coming and baseball's coming with it. Yeah. That's all that I need right now.
I agree. Target Field is a fun place
it
to
really is.
Spend some time in the summer.
It really is. I've got tickets for the home opener because my son-in-law bought me a ticket. It's good to have son-in-laws that like baseball.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it is. Sons-in-law, I should say. Okay, well, Justice Moore, thank you so much, and we will talk to you again next month.
Yeah, we'll see you in March, Rich.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, sir.
This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.